In 1847, James Simpson and two of his assistants sat down in Edinburgh to conduct a medical experiment. Although he was a top professor of midwifery, he was still doing the experiments on himself. Chloroform had been used as an anaesthetic for large animals for several years, but people said it was unsafe for humans. Well, James Simpson decided with his two assistants to sit down one evening and find out. When they woke up alive the next morning, they decided that it was safe for humans. And in God's grace, they hadn't taken too much, otherwise it might have been quite a different story. Well, what was driving James Simpson in performing these high-risk experiments? That wasn't the first one that he had conducted. He was a professor of midwifery, and he was experiencing at close hand the pain that women were having in childbirth. And so he was looking for an anaesthetic to help them. And eventually, chloroform was used by Queen Victoria. She called it That Blessed Chloroform on child number 8. And people decided it was safe to use. But as it was being put forward to use, there was a debate. Because some people, they came to Genesis chapter 3 and verse 16. And they said, look, it says there, in pain she shall bring forth children. God said it. No pain relief. Well, if you wanted to read a GCSE history textbook, you would see this is a classic incidence of science versus religion. Scientific progress being held back by religious extremists, biblical literalists. But if you get rid of GCSE textbooks, which aren't always that accurate, and you actually read the real history, you would see that James Simpson was an evangelical Christian. And he responded like this. Why did God put Adam to sleep before taking his rib? That was his response. Now, whatever we think about the exegesis, James Simpson was a man who believed that God's word said was true. And that's what he wanted to base his life upon. But I'm using that to illustrate that this text, Genesis 3 verse 16, has been much misunderstood for a long time. It's very difficult to translate, which doesn't help matters when a verse is difficult to understand or people willfully misunderstand it. So usually I like just to go straight in for the text and really try to unpack the text. But I really feel this morning, because of the misunderstanding of this text, we really need to see this in a larger context. So firstly, we're going to look at creation. Then as we look at the text more directly, we're going to look at the fall. And then thirdly, we're going to look at redemption, all applied to particularly women and their particular distinctive role that God has given them. So let's begin then this morning with looking at creation. And what have we seen as we've been looking through Genesis? We've seen man and woman in perfect partnership. Remember, as we saw the second creation account, complementary, not contradictory, that started in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, and really expanded what was going on the sixth day. What was the climax? Well, the climax, as we encountered, was God building the woman out of the rib of man to complement Adam perfectly. And we saw them two together in perfect roles. What was the man? Well, he was the head. Who was created first, as Paul says? Adam. Who received the command of God? Adam. Who was the garden guardian? Adam. Who was to seek the woman's spiritual good? Adam. And what was her role? Well, we encountered the word help. And we saw there was two ways to take that. It wasn't in the way, oh, you've been a real help. Rather, it was more in the help sense. The word used of God, she was a necessary, a vital help to Adam in this vital partnership at creation. Because it had already been stated that neither men nor women can image God individually. It needs men and women to image God together. And in a world of personal relational harmony, marriage would have been worked out like this. And marriage would have led to multiplication. After all, Genesis 1, the command comes, be fruitful an increase. Remember what blessing was? Blessing was to enrich what is good. It was enriching the relationship and to empower for abundant living. And this abundance was going to be seen in an abundance of men and women. And what was going on, as Psalm 139 would tell us, distinctively in the woman, in her womb, living replicas of God were going to be knit together. Just think about this, a world where everything was pure pleasure. Every second of marriage, every second and morning of pregnancy, every second of childbirth, every second of child rearing, 100% pure pleasure. Headship of the man seeking the spiritual good of his wife. We could say helpership of the woman, embracing that desire for her spiritual good and perfect harmony. That is the picture that's been given to us in Genesis 1 and 2. Pure pleasure, pure harmony, a perfect partnership which God has designed. Well, then let's come on to the fall and the painful conflict. In case you're thinking this is going to be very short, my points have got varying lengths this morning. The second one, fall, the painful conflict that has come. And remember, we saw the cause of the problem. Satan, that original usurper of God's authority, the one who wanted to lift himself up. What doubt did he sow in the mind of Eve? We saw several doubts, but the climactic one was this. Is man really head? We saw as we looked at Genesis 3 that the word you that Satan was using to Adam and Eve was, or to Eve, was plural. He was speaking to the woman, to Eve, for her to answer on behalf of the man and the woman. And what was he saying to Eve? Eve, don't support Adam in him seeking your spiritual good, but rather usurp his role and lead him to spiritual death. That is disaster. And that is a disaster that we find the man and the woman in as we come to our passage this morning. Eve has jettisoned this perfect partnership. She's usurped the role of Adam and she's led him to spiritual death. Now, as we'll see next week and in more detail, the man is absolutely culpable for allowing her to usurp his authority. It's in Adam, all die. He's got the blame. But the woman has still got blame for her particular role. And so we see in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 16 this morning, people turning up in court for the sentencing. God's sentence to the woman. We saw last time the sentence to the serpent, but now is the sentence comes to the woman. And let's think, what's the key thing we want to see in every good sentence in court? We want to see it fit the crime. Again, I was just reading, I think, in an illustrious paper, the local rag that came through the door. A man, terrible crime, sentenced to life. Then it said life was 19 years. I thought, not even 20 years in this case. Only 19 for this murderer. Our sentences don't fit the crime. God's sentences do fit the crime. That's where you get this kind of eye for the eye principle. So Eve, what had she done? She had rejected her role and usurped Adam's role. So the sentence to Eve comes in the area distinctive to womanhood. And if you were to say to most people who are sane today, though not to everyone, because some people are getting a bit confused on this, what is the one thing that a woman can definitely do that no man can do? The answer is, have children. If you want to say, what is the key distinctive, biologically speaking, of womanhood? There's nothing more distinctive than childrearing, and that is where we see the focus coming. And we'll see two things coming in the sentence on the woman. We'll see pain and conflict. You might say to me, well, do men experience pain? Absolutely, but not in the same way. Do men experience conflict? Absolutely. but not in this distinctive way. So we're thinking about general things that are going on, but particularly acute in the woman's case. So firstly, I'd like us to see, if you see verse 16, the breadth of the woman's sentence. I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. Now that sentence is difficult to translate, and the sense is, the word conception is used there, which translators know that when something is spoken of in this way in Hebrew, it's kind of an idiom, meaning everything from conception and all that entails onto and including childbirth. Because you might say, well, there's nothing particularly painful or sorrowful in conception. But just think about the anguish that is seen from all matters relating to conception and onwards. You could even think of the anguish going back to just the barren womb, the woman who longs to have children and is unable to. Is that not part of the fall? Or what about the weeping womb? The womb that keeps miscarrying and mourning the loss of an image bearer of God. The anguish. Think about the troubles in pregnancy. Morning sickness, cravings, cramps, complications, more. I'm sure the women could fill me in on a few dozen more things there that I've kind of omitted. There's a whole breadth of things that is going on when God is saying, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. But then there's a particular depth comes next in this pain. In pain, you shall bring forth children. Now, I have to say, and I was speaking to Heather about this, I said, well, I've seen this not experientially, but just observationally. And even observationally, it looks quite nasty. And sure, the men here who've got wives who've born children, they've been present at the birth, you have a much higher degree of respect for your wife once you've witnessed her give birth to a child. There's no depth of pain, really, in human experience like childbearing. And he's saying to the woman, this it will be your experience. This will be the pinnacle of pain. Now, I was reading the source of wisdom in the UK on pain in childbearing. Obviously, the BBC knows everything about everything. And so the BBC, I was trying to say, well, what would the world say was the reason for the pain in childbearing? And this is massive, long article. And I'd probably need a biologist to explain it all to me. But essentially, they were trying to say that there is this evolutionary theory and that evolutionary theory, and nothing was quite satisfactory, because as they keep looking on, they seem to see that animals, when they give birth, do not seem to have the same amount of pain that women do. And it just seems to be, throughout the centuries, people have always spotted that, and they haven't seemed to, even amongst the evolutionary aspect, seem to have found any explanation that has had full satisfaction. But what is the big point here? What's the point of all this pain going from conception all the way through to childbirth, hitting a pinnacle there? Well, it's a simple point. If we reject God's plan, there's going to be pain. That's what the woman had done. She'd rejected God's plan, and the consequence was pain. But there's more here, because it's not just pain, but it's conflict. And again, you might say, well, men and women both suffer from conflict. But just one look at history and current experience would suggest that in relational conflict, women seem to suffer particularly acutely. And you may well know people who you can be thinking of people now and thinking, yeah, that is a woman in a really bad situation, or has been in a bad situation. And there is acute problems from conflict. And again, we said this fits the nature of the crime, that the woman has subverted God's marital order at the fall. Well, so much is fairly straightforward, but now the problems begin, because I'm guessing if I had people before me this morning with four translations, you've probably got four different translations of Genesis 3, verse 16. And in fact, even if you've got the ESV, you need to be looking at the date your ESV was translated, because if it's 2011, it's translated in one way, and if it's 2016, it's translated in a different way. Now, what's going on here? Well, what's partly going on here is that the Hebrew word for two is very, very flexible. So if you're reading in Hebrew, you wouldn't have any problem. But in English, we just think, well, if it says two, that means two. But Hebrew two could mean for or toward or against. There's flexibility in the word and how it's translated. So let me just see if we can deal with this as best I understand it this morning. Let's just rule one option out of court. Some people would suggest, evangelical feminists would say, headship is part of the curse. So before the fall, man wasn't head, but the punishment for the fall is that man becomes head, and therefore when a woman's saved, he's no longer head. How do we know that's not true? When we read 1 Timothy chapter 2, we read together that Paul said that Adam was created first, not Eve. So Paul rooted in 1 Corinthians 2 the headship of man, not in the fall, but in creation. And then he made a separate point about the fall and women being deceived. But Paul in 1 Timothy 2 clearly rooted headship in the creational order, as he also does in 1 Corinthians when he talks about the head of every woman is man. And he also goes back to creation there. So headship is not part of the curse. So we've ruled that one out. Now, the Bible is usually helpful in it doesn't, most doctrines don't hang on one word. Now, if we think, well, this word to or for or towards or against could be translated in different ways, let's look at the word desire. Your desire. Now, this is a rare word in the Bible. We've really got two options. We could translate it along with Song of Solomon's 7 verse 10. That's where it also occurs. It only occurs three places here and in two other places. Song of Solomon 7:10 says, I am my beloved's and his desire is for me. So do we think, does it fit the context that the desire of a man for a woman, relational or desire for the marital embrace is part of the curse? Does that fit the context? No. So we rule that one out of court. So there, what are we left with? Well, Genesis 4:7, very helpful because it's just a few paragraphs on in the writing. And here we see God speaking to Cain, who's tempted to kill Abel. And what does God say to Cain? God says this, if you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for or against you, but you must rule over it. Do you notice the massive, strong parallels with Genesis 3:16? What is the desire that sin has for Cain? Sin wants its way with Cain. Sin is crouching at the door like an animal saying, I want you. It wants its way with Cain. And that is the desire that I believe that is being spoken of in Genesis 3 and verse 16. Which is why it has been translated recently in the ESV. Your desire shall be contrary to your husband. As in against your husband. As in there's a struggle there. You are desperate to have your own way. Just like it was in Genesis 4:7. That's the woman's desire. She's wanted to go her own way, and God said, right, you want to go your own way? Well, have it. See what it's like when your desire is against your husband. What's that going to be like? That's what you wanted. And what's the result? Well, what did God say to Cain? As sin desired to have its own way with him, it said to Cain, you shall, or you must, rule over it. Now, was God saying to Cain, well, and you should, in the way that a man should lovingly look after his wife, just lovingly look after sin? No. What's he saying? You shall rule it, you shall dominate it, you shall crush it. That is this sense of domination, you shall rule. And so this is part of the fall, is that as the woman strives over against the husband for domination, he will then dominate her. Not biblically, leader, not lovingly look after her, but that will go on. And so, what do we see? We see two terrible things. We see wives desiring to get their own way against the husbands, and husbands putting the women in their place with a domineering attitude. So what is part of the curse? Domineering manhood. So if you're saying today, well, the man's head, and I've got to make sure I'm head and put her in a place. Well, you're just saying, I'd like to operate in a sinful way as part of the curse. That's not good. So it's not saying that's a good thing. That's saying that that is the way it is in the world. If women have unlocked this disastrous subversion of God's design in marriage, then you've just got this constant struggle. She wants to come up. He's trying to push her down, up, down. This is terrible. And you can probably think of a lot of relationships where this disaster is going on. It's not nice. But, and I'm not even coming to redemption yet, though we will do in a few minutes. Just here, just pause, just with Genesis 3 verse 16, can we think about the mercy of God? Now you might be saying to me, well, is this really the curse? Because I don't see the word curse used for the woman. Well, it's always been seen as part of the curse, and why is that? Well, what does it mean to be a curse? Well, it means to be delivered over to misfortune. Well, has the woman been delivered over to misfortune? Yes. What does a curse do? It prevents an otherwise healthy course of events. Is that what happens here? Yes. But where then is the mercy? Well, just look back to what he said to the serpent. The Lord God said to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you. The woman is not directly cursed. Yes, she experiences the effects of a cursed world with pain and conflict, but the serpent was personally cursed. God said to the serpent, no way back, eternal damnation. He's not saying that for the woman. Where then is the mercy? There's also mercy in the way God says it. Do you remember what would happen if she ate of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? God said, you will surely die. What does God say here? I will surely, same way of saying it, multiply your pain. So what's he saying? She is dying. Yes, she's died spiritually by being separated from God. But he's not putting the full sentence on her yet. He's giving her time, and he's giving her a sharp warning that says, this is serious. Now, are you glad that when you put your hand on the oven and it's hot, that you immediately go and draw it back? Is that a good thing? It is, because if you left your hand there, this is why leprosy is so terrible, you leave your hand there and your hand you'll be terribly affected, permanently injured. So pain, in that sense of drawing your hand away, is a good thing. And this is the mercy of God. And this acute pain should say to every woman and every man, how serious must sin be if the time of the woman's greatest joy in childbirth is a time of such sorrow? How serious must sin be if God had to put such a strong experience right across the world, right across time, and say, do you understand how serious sin is? The devil doesn't want us to think sin is serious. He wants us to have a little conversation with him, like he had with Eve. But God says, look how serious sin is. But what do we see as well with the woman? When it says, I will multiply your pain in childbearing, in pain you shall bring forth children, what has he already said to the serpent? He's already said to the serpent, there's going to be someone to reverse the curse. So when he says to the woman, you will bear children, it might be in pain, but he's saying, the deliverer's coming. He's coming. So even in the curse on the woman, the promise of blessing is coming, because he's guaranteeing, if God says it's going to happen, children are going to be born. And only through children being born would the seed come who is going to reverse the curse. So it confirms that a seed will come. And finally, part of God's mercy, although there may be other aspects of mercy. But finally, for me this morning on the areas of mercy, what has God done? We'll see this next week as well as we look at the curse on the man particularly. But which areas did God curse? He cursed areas that people are most likely to idolize. You can see people, you have the things called businesses like Precious Little Ones. And you've got a whole industry, how you can get everything, you can get pictures and this and that. It's just, you can see, children can easily become idols. And you can easily, some people just seem to live for their children or grandchildren. What is their satisfaction, children or grandchildren? And God is saying here, your ultimate satisfaction is not in your children. It must be in me and in me alone. Don't find your ultimate satisfaction in them and the pain and conflict that I'll bring in this area of relationship and childbearing reminds you of that. So then we have this mercy of God. But as we come to conclusion this morning, I want us to look forward a bit as well. Let's think about redemption, because we need to think back to where we have started. Because there was James Simpson, and what was he doing? He was seeking to mitigate pain in childbirth. Was that right? Was that wrong? Well, we can see James Simpson with Common Grace. And as far as I understand it, I'm not an expert in childbirth, that whatever pain relief is given, it doesn't seem to deal with everything. It's still an unpleasant business. But in God's grace, as we can see, His common grace, childbirth is not as dangerous as it used to be, certainly in the West. And this makes us think about saving grace. Because have you ever reflected on this? Christ's saving grace doesn't just redeem us out of the world, but it mitigates and reduces the effects of the fall and our experience of the curse in this world. We're not saying that redemption is redemption from male headship, because that was part of God's original good design. But rather, what happens when the curse reverser gets to work in our lives? Well, he is, if you're a Christian this morning, and if you're a man or a woman who's married or may be married in the future, he's at work by a spirit in your heart, preparing you to relate in a marriage situation, or just in a general situation of relationship, in a way that is right and true and good. So what does that mean? Well, it's saying to the man that you are being redeemed from a domineering or a dominating or a I'll have it my way kind of approach. That's what the Spirit does. So what does he do? He comes into the man and works in his heart that his first priority might be the woman's spiritual good. We read at the start of the service from Ephesians 5 that husbands were to love their wives as Christ loved the church, to cleanse her. What's that? That's her spiritual good. That's what men are to do. So, let me ask the men amongst us, how far are you and I driven by the desire to dominate? And you can say, no, but her desire is contrary to me, but she does this, she does that. God says, no. You worry about you. How far are you and I driven by a desire to dominate? Or how far are you and I driven by a desire for the spiritual good of your wife and her sanctification? And I've certainly found this is very painful, this necessity, because once you have the responsibility to seek your wife's sanctification, that really does turbocharge the need for your own sanctification, because otherwise you feel a gross hypocrite. You think, well, I've got to work on my own sanctification. I don't really want to work on that area, but I need to work on that area because I need to have myself in a spiritual frame where I can look at the sanctification of someone else. That is what redemption does to men. And our experience should be, the longer we live as men, the more we're driven by the spiritual goods of our wives, if we have them. And what about for women? Well, It means not being sucked into the struggle for domination. Now, there's a very striking way that Paul speaks in 1 Timothy 2, verse 15. And this is where we're going to finish this morning, with 1 Timothy 2:15. Sometimes you think, well, it's really helpful when the Old Testament is explained by the New Testament. But sometimes when you read 1 Timothy 2:15, you think, Paul, you're explaining a difficult passage in the Old Testament. You seem to have given me another difficult passage in return. And this is the phrase, have you ever reflected on this? She shall be saved through childbearing. And we thought, well, hang on a second, I'm not old enough to bear children. I'm not married. I'm not able to bear children. What's this about? Well, this is the way that they thought then. When Paul is speaking about women, and in the context of women who've rejected God's design for them, he decides to pick the thing that is most distinctive for women to represent their entire role. Just like the seventh commandment does this, when it talks about ruling out all sexual sin, it picks on adultery as the most grievous form of sexual sin because it's the breaking of the marriage covenant. But it's ruling out the whole sexual sin. Here, this is speaking about the whole of the role of women, and it picks out the most distinctive thing about a role of women, and it is childbearing. It's not talking about whether she bears children or not. As such, it's talking about her embracing her role. It said she will be saved through it. Now, being saved, we could say, what must I do to be saved? That's justification. We could say, he who endures to the end will be saved. That's final glorification. But here, this is thinking more like this, that the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to those who are being saved, it's the power of God. That's sanctification. So it's saying this woman will be sanctified by childbearing, by embracing her role. That's what it's saying. A woman will be sanctified by embracing the distinctive Genesis 1 and 2 role that God has given her. How does she do this? Through faith. It says there, if they continue in faith. Ladies, let me ask you, who are you trusting to know what's best for you? Common culture? Or God and his word? Continue in not just faith, but love. Love for the Saviour first, and therefore love for others flows out as you embrace your role. The most loving thing you can do is to embrace your role. And what's next? Holiness. What are you looking for in a husband? Looks, money, fame, good surname. Heather downgraded there. Or are you looking for someone to seek your sanctification? If they continue in holiness. We saw it in the midweek about Joshua, or rather Caleb. If he wanted to have someone who was going to marry his daughter, it has to be someone who was going to go to war. And the picture there is a war on sin. And finally, self-control, it says here. Do you want to give yourself over to the Spirit to allow the curse reverser to work in you? James Simpson was asked by a journalist, what is your greatest discovery? Simpson wasn't cooperating with the journalist, and he said, my greatest discovery was this, that I'm a great sinner. And Jesus Christ is a great Saviour. And what greater witness can we be to a world that has no answer to pain and just revels in relational conflict than to see the curse reverser at work in us, sanctifying our relationships? May that be true of us in whatever relationship we have, that we give ourselves over to the Spirit, that he might sanctify us through and through, and make us into those who can embrace the roles that God has designed us to have. Amen.